Well, good morning, everyone.
Good morning.
Welcome to 2017 Rohatsu. Somehow, 2,600 years ago, and half a world away from us, there was an event that happened. Siddhartha's awakening. And kind of miraculously, we still commemorate that. We remember that event. Some Buddhist groups refer to this as Bodhi Day. Bodhi Day, meaning day of awakening. In the Zen tradition in Japan, it's called Rohatsu, which unfortunately doesn't have a really like profound meaning. It means the eighth day of the 12th month in the old calendar. And as Kate has already kind of indicated at the opening announcements, it's typical for Zen monks and some lay followers to stay up the entire night before the eighth day, right, practicing meditation, but usually as part of an intensive session. And from my own experience, I can say it's easier to spend the entire night meditating with the help of doing it after 6 or 7 days of sitting anyway. Somehow it just seems a little easier than just kind of plopping down and spending one night meditating. But maybe we can use the energy that we accumulated from earlier, as Kate mentioned, and just keep going. When I thought about this talk, I noticed a kind of a strong reluctance arose in me, because how could I possibly have anything meaningful or helpful to say about the awakening of Siddhartha Gautama, that time when he became a Buddha, the one who is awake? And it's not that his awakening seems too sacred or mystical to approach, because after all, that's been the theme of Rohatsu talks for hundreds and hundreds of years in China, Japan, and Korea. It's in part that so much has been written and spoken about this awakening or enlightenment of various kinds that I feel some of us think, maybe kind of a common feeling, is that we have somehow kind of a handle on it, however shaky that handle is. Like so much in this day and age, enlightenment has become a kind of commodity. Something we don't have yet, perhaps, but something we need for our happiness, along with our ageless skin, bright shiny teeth, and the right diet. So enlightenment can be just another object of desire. Something the ego wants, right? One more gold star. But this one will last forever. Unfortunately, this noun, enlightenment, and our, I would say, general or common understanding of it as some kind of single epiphany really obscures and misleads the early Buddhist texts, and most of the writings of our ancestors are really clear that we don't get zapped and are transformed into something else. But we do undertake this lifelong journey of spiritual growth, which includes both sudden and gradual transformations. And even in the legendary story of Siddhartha Gautama's great experience under the Bodhi tree, we read that he continued to practice and meditate until he died. He continued to devote his life to practice and, of course, shared his understanding up until his final breath out. So, I don't like the word enlightenment. I like the word awakening. I think awakening is better thought of because it's a verb, right? We can talk about awakening, to awake. Waking up to our whole being with nothing left out. As I think most of us know here, Siddhartha did not start out as a young man looking for answers to life's most challenging problems or questions. It was a long and arduous journey for him before he sat under the Bodhi tree, the tree of awakening. And perhaps it's a journey that reflects much of your own life. His mother died shortly after he was born. But according to the Buddhist myths and legends, throughout his childhood and teenage years, he lived a very easy and even pampered life. His father, a king, fearing that his son would be attracted to the religious life, tried his utmost to minimize all suffering and disappointment in the life of his young son, Siddhartha. Like most parents, the king wanted his son to be happy, to be free of the pains of life. And so he sheltered Siddhartha as much as possible from the sorrows and sadness of the human condition. I think all parents do this. Siddhartha's father made sure his son was healthy, had good food, that his son was content, providing him with whatever was needed. So, like Siddhartha, I think most of us here grew up and had fairly comfortable lives, at least physically. You know, enough food, warm clothing, education, medicine when we were ill, protection from outside dangers. And just like Siddhartha, perhaps we too were entertained with our, maybe with our virtual storytellers, musicians, dancing girls. Siddhartha grew up without facing any major challenge. He grew up ignorant of the truths of the human condition. Until one night when he asked his charioteer to take him into the nearby town. And there, again, according to the legends and myths, he saw clearly what had been hidden from him for so long. He saw the truth of sickness, old age, and death. Clearly, for the first time. And from this sudden, deep seeing of the human condition and realizing that he and everyone he loved is subject to sickness, old age, and death. I think it shocked him profoundly. And Siddhartha on that journey also saw a mendicant, a wandering monk, and decided at that point that he too would take up the holy life, to learn how to live in the face of this disturbing realization that he had. This is also the story of our life, I think. As in the story of Siddhartha, something appears in our life, some tragedy or loss, or maybe it's not so dramatic, but a growing discontent with our circumstances. And so we become increasingly aware that the world is not as we wish it to be, that we cannot make the world give us what we want and take away what we don't want. Perhaps we slowly or quickly come to see our life for what it really is, largely out of our control. So we begin. We begin the long journey, like Siddhartha did, looking, looking for answers to questions that maybe we can't even clearly articulate to ourselves. But we know we must seek and bring forth courage and fortitude. The first practices that Siddhartha took up did not prove very fruitful. According to legend, Siddhartha studied with at least two famous teachers at that time, Alakara Kalama and Udaka Ramaputta. And he made great progress. He showed great aptitude as a student and quickly mastered all the meditation practices and the doctrines that those teachers held. But in each case, he felt he really hadn't quite got the answer to this profound question of misery and suffering that he was looking for, to those questions that had really sparked deep in his heart. So he kept on searching. And this is what I really most admire about Siddhartha. He has profound patience and great courage to keep on questioning and seeking, rather than simply become a teacher and have lots of students and be admired for the accomplishments he had. He kept going. And not only that, but he didn't go back to the palace, which I would have done, and indulge again in good food, music, and dancing girls. And Netflix. He didn't give in to the seduction of kingship or of just doing whatever he could to kind of be numb to the suffering of the world. And one of our challenges is not to give in to the seduction of the material world, to not believe the messages of advertisements that our life's meaning and happiness is to be found in various acquisitions, in iPhone 10, designer jeans, etc. And not to give up when our practice doesn't seem to be working as we expected it to. So Siddhartha then took up the practice of severe austerities, following a very common practice and teaching at that time, that you practice by crushing sense desires, and that by that way liberation could be obtained. In the early texts, I'm going to give you a quote here. This is what Siddhartha is talking about his own experience at this time. He says, "My body became extremely emaciated. Simply from eating so little, my limbs became like the jointed segments of vine stems or bamboo stems. My backside became like a camel's hoof. My spine stood out like a string of beads. My ribs jutted out like the jutting rafters of an old run-down barn. The gleam in my eyes appeared to be sunk deep in my eye sockets, like the gleam of water in a well." And most of us would not willingly take up austerities to that extent. But for me, this is a very moving passage because it evokes my father, who had a severe heart condition. And this is what he looked like at the end of his life. Sunk. His eyes sunk deep in his eye sockets. But for Siddhartha, no liberation came, only exhaustion and despair. And then Siddhartha remembered a simple meditation that he experienced as a youth while watching his father do a ceremonial plowing of a field. And again, here's his words. "I recall once when my father, the Shakyan, was working and I was sitting in the cool shade of a rose apple tree. Then, quite withdrawn from sensuality, withdrawn from unskillful mental qualities, I entered and remained in the first jhana, state of tranquility. And there, clarity and ease arose. Could that be the path to awakening? Then, following on that memory, came the realization, surely this is the path to awakening. So Siddhartha vowed to follow that path. He took some nourishment and bathed. Well, that's the other thing, you don't bathe when you're doing these austerities. And then his five friends, who were also ascetics, who had accompanied him during these severe austerities, thought that he had given up and left him thinking, Gotama, the contemplative, is living luxuriously, having abandoned his exertion and is backsliding into abundance. So Siddhartha then resolved to sit under a tree and follow this path of meditation to its very end. And as he was arranging himself, a young woman named Sujata came by him and with an offering of rice and milk to give to a local tree spirit, which happened to be the tree that Siddhartha was, that spirit resided in the tree that Siddhartha was sitting under. So again, a little quote from the early texts. As soon as Sujata caught sight of the future Buddha, she was exceedingly overjoyed, supposing him to be the tree spirit. And as she advanced, she kept constantly bowing. And taking the pot from her head, she uncovered it, and with some flower-scented water in a golden vase, drew near and took up a position close to Siddhartha. Then Siddhartha looked at Sujata, and she perceived that he was a holy man, and did obeisance and said, Lord, accept my donation and go where you please. And adding, may your wishes prosper like my own. And she departed. So Siddhartha ate her offering, and well fed, faced east under the Bodhi tree, and began to meditate, looking deeply at his own and at the human condition. In later biographies, it is said that at this point, Mara, the tempter, the personification of ignorance itself, realized that Siddhartha would become a Buddha, and in becoming a Buddha would be outside Mara's control. And Mara cried, Prince Siddhartha is desirous of passing beyond my control, but I will never allow it. He went and announced the news to his army, and sounding the Mara war cry, drew out for battle. Isn't that often the case? You know, you sit down, and you're quiet and at ease, and meditation cushion, and then suddenly an old wound like opens up, right? And that story about that stupid so-and-so, how could he, how could she, just start to bubble up again. I think that's Mara, kind of like whispering in our ears, remember the time when. Now, I think many of us have seen the movie Little Buddha with Keanu Reeves. Remember that movie? Mm-hmm. A little bit? And so we know that despite the attacks by the great armies of Mara, Siddhartha remained on his meditation cushion. But really, you know, the attacks by the army were child's play. The strongest weapons of Mara that Siddhartha and we have to contend with are the very ones that we experience, of course, on our own cushion, discontent, lust, doubt, fear, boredom, greed, hate, and so on. You could probably make your own list. So these sometimes referred to as the daughters of Mara or the siblings of Mara. And we each face them just like Siddhartha did. So Siddhartha faced all the demons that Mara had sent to him to try unseat him, get him off his cushion. But he remained calm and upright in his seat. And finally, Mara made one last attempt to unseat Siddhartha using a very sneaky maneuver. Mara said, "Siddhartha, arise from this seat. It does not belong to you, but to me." So Mara questioned Siddhartha's merit and worth to be awakened by wielding that heavy crudgel of self-doubt. "Who do you think you are? You can't do this." You ever had those feelings? "Who do we think I am, sitting here?" So trying to smash that sense of self-worth. I think we've all experienced the thought in the Zendo, you know, at times, you know, here's everyone sitting in very deep samadhi and meditation except me. I'm the only one who's reviewing high school trauma or something like that. So, as the legend goes, Siddhartha then asked Mara, "Who is witness to your worth to have this seat?" And Siddhartha replied, "All these, as many as you see here, are my witnesses." And he stretched out his hands in the direction of his army. And instantly from Mara's army came the roar, "We are his witness, we are his witness." And then Mara, seeing the Buddha was alone and having no one to vouch for his worthiness, called out to Siddhartha, "Who's your witness?" And Siddhartha reached out his hand and gently touched the earth. He said, "The earth is my witness." And as the text say, "The mighty earth thundered, I bear you witness, with 100,000 roars as if to overwhelm the army of Mara." And it did. And at this, the armies of Mara fled in panic. And Mara, seeing he was alone, also turned and left. And this is true of us, too. The earth is our witness, as we said, the mountains. Robert Aiken, who brought kind of one of the early people who really brought and taught Zen in America, often wrote, you know, "I sit with mountains. I sit with mountains." And we do. So Siddhartha then continued to sit and entered deeply into the truth of the reality of his life. He meditated for 7 days, and throughout the last and seventh night, he had a number of profound insights. And then, when he saw the morning star rise, his mind became illuminated. Siddhartha realized the dependent arising of all existence, that everything is woven together. He fully understood what he later called the Four Noble Truths, the nature of dukkha, dissatisfaction, the cause of its arising, the cessation of its arising, the path that leads to that sensation, cessation. He understood the nature of non-self and a whole bunch of other things. And he said, when I realized this, my mind was free from desire. My mind was freed from ignorance. And as I became free, I realized that I was free. Ignorance was destroyed. Knowledge arose. Darkness was destroyed. Light arose. At this moment, Siddhartha became the Buddha, the one who is awake. And according to the Zen tradition, he said, I and the great earth and all beings simultaneously achieve the way. I and the great earth and all beings simultaneously achieve the way. Of course, we don't know really what he said. But really, what a startling thing if this was the case. What a startling thing to say. I mean, wouldn't it be more appropriate to say something like, I got it? Or, Eureka, I did it, finally accomplished it. And really, what is it about together with all beings in this earth? And what would you say? What will you say when tomorrow morning, as you sit here and you wake up a little bit from your drowsy zazen and you see the morning star coming through the ceiling there, what will you say? And what do you say when insight comes to you, even if it's not, you know, profound, even when it's just a solution to a problem? Shakyamuni Buddha, in his awakening to the great nature of reality, came to see that he did not stand outside. He did not transcend the world. He was not separate from the myriad beings and everything that was around him. Not separate even from the distant morning star. As he awoke on his seat, the morning star entered his eyes, untying the habitual knotty sense of self, and Buddha opened to the inherent intimacy of all things. Now it's almost time to end the talk, but I'd like to share with you one of my favorite poems by the Venerable Bhikkhuni Sita. Comes from a collection of awakening poems of the early nuns at the time of the Buddha. Venerable Bhikkhu Sita left us this poem of her experience on the top of Vulture Peak, which is a place in India where the Buddha taught, and a place of pilgrimage today as well. People go to Vulture Peak. And this poem she wrote in her old age. Though I am thin, sick, and lean on a stick, I have climbed up Vulture Peak. Robe thrown down, bowl I turn over, leaned on a rock. Imagine her up Vulture Peak, exhausted, takes off the outer robe, puts it down. She's probably hot and sweaty. Takes her begging bowl, turns it over to stop dirt and stuff from getting in, leans against a rock. There's a bit more. Though I am thin, sick, and lean on a stick, I have climbed up a vulture peak. Robe thrown down, bowl I turn over, leaned on a rock. Then great darkness opened up. After the Buddha awoke, of course, he continued to live and teach until he was an old man. And there are many stories about his life and teachings. I hope this story that we have talked about today, about the Buddha's awakening, will be of some aid in our own journey. And if in no other way, then just to know that we're not alone in our journey. We're part of a long lineage of those who have taken this path to awakening into the true vastness of being. So however long you're able to stay today, tonight, the Zendo will be open all hours in the morning, so if you wake up and you can't get back to sleep, you know where to come. Just sit with a little bit of ease, remembering this connection that we have with all from the Buddha all the way through these 2,600 years up until today. People realizing, oh, we each need to walk this path. And we do it not alone. We do it with multitudes. Thank you.